Well, it gives me great pleasure to open this afternoon's part of proceedings by introducing Julius Grieve, who's from the University of Oldenburg, right. And is a noted expert in Cormac McCarthy, perhaps the greatest expert outside of the country.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
And Julius told me last night, I'm sure he won't mind me saying, that he's just been given a contract for a book to come out on Cormac McCarthy.
Right.
So
sure.
This may be part of that book, is
it? Maybe part, yeah.
So he's going to talk to us about the Kekule problem in Cormac McCarthy's Concept of Nature.
All right, thank you very much, Keith. I want to start by thanking Patrick O'Connor, for organizing this already immensely productive workshop on Cormac McCarthy's relation to philosophy, and in particular as the author has evoked it in his essay, The Kekule Problem. And it's been an enjoyable day so far already. I think this gathering is needed because it certainly helps to meet and discuss the matters at hand in order to wrap our head around the sheer weirdness of McCarthy's essay, the form in which its argument proceeds. What I want to do in this talk is two things. First, I want to address the singular status of the essay in the context of McCarthy's larger oeuvre, insofar as it differs generically from his usual writings, novels, plays, screenplays, and short stories, even though I will exclusively talk about his fiction. Second, and in consequence of what in part follows from the question of genre vis-a-vis the Kekule problem, I want to explore in what sense McCarthy's reflections in that essay might correspond to the conceptions of nature in contemporary thinkers like Manuel de Landa or 19th century philosophers like Friedrich Wilhelm Joseph Schelling, and how that link may be important for future reconsiderations of his novels with respect to nature, the concept of nature. The 2017 essay, which McCarthy published in the journal Nautilus, has a subtitle which asks, "Where did language come from?" However, he doesn't start his short piece of nonfiction with questions concerning the inquiry into the structure of language specifically, as would have been appropriate for a text that the journal's editors have categorized as a cover story in the field of linguistics. Rather, he starts by straightforwardly explaining the title of his essay, which directly refers to, quote, "the best known of scientific problems solved in the sleep of the inquirer," unquote. And that's McCarthy, of course. This problem is so well known, in fact, that its imagery is recapitulated in a recent blockbuster called Arrival, which, apart from its medium, genre, and thematic setup as a science fiction movie that includes time travel and 12 alien spacecraft landing on planet Earth, has everything to do with what McCarthy elaborates on, that is, the origin of language and its relation to the unconscious. What's striking is that the story of Friedrich August Kekule and the way in which he unconsciously discovered, according to McCarthy, the structure of the benzene compound. It's not an example from the world of literature, linguistics, or psychology, but rather from 19th century chemistry. The deceptively clear notion that, quote unquote, one thing can be another thing extends from the metaphorical realm of narrative art all the way to the natural sciences, McCarthy claims, thus making a case for a certain continuum of the sciences and the arts. He even underlines this implicit assertion performatively by starting with Kekule's night shift insight that the molecule compound has to resemble the form of an Ouroboros, sorry for the mispronunciation, or Ouroboros, I don't know, a snake that feeds off itself. To advance our understanding of molecules, the scientist and the scholar, for that matter, needs to be able to take one thing for another. And so does McCarthy, in this first attempt at a philosophical essay with literary witticism instead of a literary work with philosophical reflection, as is the case normally. To scrutinize the problem of language and its origin in the unconscious, he tells us, we, quote, "we have to set aside the jargon of modern psychology and get back to biology," unquote. When reading such a statement, the type of genre in which it is posed makes all the difference for its interpretation. If a given literary critic has up until now refused to take seriously McCarthy's fascination with the natural sciences, now is the time to reconsider such a reading. Unlike a novel, it is perhaps easier to decide whether a particular claim or argument in a philosophical essay is meant literally or whether it points towards something else. While the reader of a novel about scientists working on cognitive neuroscience, for instance, might put to question each and every one of the statements uttered within the novel, in the Kekulé problem, mostly one would expect actual proposals, less traps, to baffle the reader with science jargon. We do expect sentences of the following kind, quote, the unconscious is a biological system before it is anything else, unquote. Although this is in fact a quote from the essay, we also need to acknowledge that the letter ends with a question and not with a conclusion, namely, are you sure? This is how the essay ends, interestingly. What is crucial here, among other things, is the position established by the author in contradistinction to his still persisting image of a romantic recluse who lives apart from literary circles and whose opinions are thought to be expressed exclusively in his many novels. Indeed, the inevitable question concerning the Kekulé problem is whether or not, at long last, we have the ultimate authority in our midst with respect to his own fiction, subtly attacking the function of the critic who would normally write an essay on a similar topic and perhaps in a related style of writing, emulating that of his or her favorite author alive. Yet what is even more crucial in McCarthy's reframing of Kekulé's dream is his unwillingness to see the origin of things expressed linguistically in language itself. Quote, problems, he says, are often well-posed in terms of language, and language remains a handy tool for explaining them, but the actual process of thinking in any discipline is largely an unconscious affair. Unquote. Instead of the unconscious being structured like a language, it is the biological condition of possibility for the necessarily partial narrative exposition of things in the world. Like the relationship between antecedents and consequence, that between unconscious thought and linguistic construction, the former is much more powerful than the latter in terms of sheer cognitive capacity, and yet any given inquirer only has the latter at his or her disposal. Which, according to McCarthy, includes mathematical and musical forms of notation. Ontologically speaking, nature's capacity for the production and proliferation of thought antecedes that of culture, and yet it is only from the standpoint of culture that this antecedence becomes meaningful. Meaning is consequence, as McCarthy puts it later in his essay. At some point, and we've already heard this quote, right? I mean, at some point, the mind must grammaticize facts and convert them to narrative. The facts of the world do not, for the most part, come in narrative form. We have to do that. In answering the question concerning the place of the origin of language, McCarthy readily replies, the unconscious. Yet, according to him, it is a biological operative and language is not, as he says. Therefore, he suggests turning toward the natural sciences rather than the analysis of culture and its languages and psychologies, or better still, he recommends the consideration of naturalistic research in debates on culture dynamics. This is a move that resembles Manuel de Landa in his 1997 book, A Thousand Years of Nonlinear History, which put geological, biological, social, and linguistic trajectories of the past millennium on one and the same footing of what he termed the continuum of a single matter energy undergoing phase transitions of various kinds. As he puts it, rocks and winds, germs and words are all different manifestations of this dynamic material reality, or in other words, they all represent the different ways in which the single matter energy expresses itself. As much as history has infiltrated physics, we must now allow physics to infiltrate human history. While there's a lot to unpack in this quotation, I think that McCarthy's essay and also his novels negotiate precisely the conceptual territory de Landa evokes here, namely first, the leveling of all phenomena and things in the world in terms of what could be called a physiocentric continuum, and second, the ontological importance of the natural sciences for the humanities, and consequently, the dismissal of the ontological supervenience upon ethics. In Cormacian parlance, we can also say this in the following way, no cultural operative like language without the preceding biological operative, like the unconscious, and yet meaningful narrative arises out of the meaningless at the same time that the understanding that one thing can be another thing is at the root of all things in the world, as McCarthy says. McCarthy's argument, which really hinges on the biological grounds for the existence of parables, of what he calls tales whose meanings give one pause. Here puts forward not so much a middle ground between a psychological reading of nature and an eliminativist reduction of meaning-making to physical causes, as he does an ontological prioritization of non-human nature with respect to its apprehension via human language. Moreover, he does this without negating the latter's relative autonomy, language's autonomy. In this respect, and perhaps surprisingly, to some at least, McCarthy's concept of nature resonates strongly with the German idealist philosopher Schelling in the following statement from his late Philosophy of Revelation. "For it is not because there is thinking that there is being, but rather because there is being that there is thinking. The antecedence of biological dynamics yields the consequence of meaningful narrative, but this does not mean that biology has a more effective purchase on language that linguistics does not. Again, language is not a biological operative, even though it is the consequent of it." Returning to the circle established by the snake that feeds off its own tail, while signifying the molecular structure of benzene, I want to propose that the concept of nature evoked in McCarthy's fictional universe by literary rather than philosophical means has to do with a fundamental distinction made in the philosophy of cognition or neurophilosophy between allopoiesis and autopoiesis, that is, between the production of individual beings from a source that exceeds these beings, on the one hand, and on the other, the self-production and reproduction of beings independent of a source that is excessive of their being. In literary terms, allegory, which I take to be nearly synonymous with the notion of parable in McCarthy's sense, would accordingly be aligned with the possibility that one thing can be another thing, that a snake can be a chemical compound structure. The other term of the two unequal halves, ontologically prior to that possibility of symbolization, which denotes the path from the unconscious to what might be termed the linguistic apparatus of capture, would be that of tautology, which is a concept that Schelling makes use of in his Philosophy of Mythology to explain the power and influence of religious and mythological narratives throughout the ages. And he takes that term from Coleridge, interestingly enough. Scripture, Schelling notes, is not what it is merely because it connotes another, more fundamental reality, but because it literally means what it says. Along these lines, McCarthy's conceptualization of the unconscious vis-a-vis language implies that the former is not what it is because it is of the same order as the latter, but because it is both self-organizing and the condition of possibility of the organization of phenomena outside of its reach. Unconscious thought, McCarthy states, is just not used to giving verbal instructions. And the fact that it appears to be less than insistent upon our remembering every dream suggests that sometimes it may be working on itself. In opposition to any kind of ethically or politically motivated reading of McCarthy's works, perhaps we should neither talk of a categorical nor allegorical imperative guiding his narrative strategies. Instead, what is at issue might be called a tautological imperative, in which one realm of nature can be another, in which allegory and tautology coexist in both the same continuum of what Delanda terms matter energy, yet in which, even on the level of chemical structures, unconscious thought exceeds that of language and its human practitioners to an immeasurable degree. At what point, one might ask, do chemistry and mythology, the discovery of benzene and the narrative of the snake meet? At what point in human history can we discern an actual convergence of these two realms of allopoiesis and autopoiesis, of allegory and tautology? As a concluding passage, which will have to suffice as a provisional answer to these two interrelated questions, I want to quote from McCarthy's 1979 novel, Sutri, and it's pointing toward what I've described as the conceptualization of nature by literary rather than philosophical means. The following passage, then, is set in the latter part of the novel, quote, "in the spring of Cornelius Sutri's third year on the river," unquote, which intimates how the rainy season amplifies Sutri's contemplative tendencies while living on his houseboat that drifts in the thick current among trash cans, animal cadavers, and even a dead baby floating in the mud. "Oaring his way lightly through the rain among these curiosa, he felt little more than yet another artifact leaching out of the earth and washed along, draining down out of the city. Sutri among the leavings, like a mote in the floor of a beaker, come summer a bit of matter stunned and drying in the curing mud, the terra damnata of the city's dead alchemy. The fish he raised up from the flood in the season themselves look stunned. In 1979, McCarthy's answer to the question concerning the origins of language, and by the same token the genesis of forms, appears to be deceptively straightforward. Where did language come from? It came from the alchemical dynamism of the Tennessee River, or Cloaca Maxima, ready to permeate all forms of life that there are or will be. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Julius. And I'm sure there are going to be lots of questions. So although it's been established as a convention that I should ask you a couple of questions to begin with, I'm going to try and keep them quite short to give other people the opportunity to ask. The first question really is a question of clarification or elucidation. And I think towards the beginning of your talk, your paper, you mentioned nature's capacity for thought. And I just wondered if you could sort of draw out a bit what that might mean in McCarthy's terms, nature's capacity for thought.
We've talked about, like, in the earlier discussions after the papers, we've talked about the distinction he makes between language, human language, and signaling in animals. And that's something that's crucial in McCarthy, but I think that he doesn't equate thought with language, and that's important, I think, in his novels and also in the Kekulé problem. I think one of the things we need to consider is kind of in philosophy of cognition, like the idea of what they call panpsychism, that there might be kind of an idea of sentience that is mentioned actually in Blood Meridian and also in The Crossing, a level of sentience that's non-human, but that could be called thought. So and I think, like, McCarthy's conception of nature accounts for that non-human way of thinking. I don't want to say non-human agency so much as like a form of thought that that predates and also is aligned with language, but that is kind of different in terms of how it is set up. So the idea that one thing can be another thing is a particular feature in human thought and in linguistic expression. But that's just one option, or that's just one way of articulating thought within natural process. And I find that fascinating, that in a way, for McCarthy, literature is not a human practice or a narrative art that is fundamentally about that which it speaks. It is also that, but it is also, but it's more fundamentally a late, we could almost say a late accretion of nature. So his concept of nature is not just about nature, but it is fundamentally of it. Mm. That's why I refer to Delanda, like, it, you know, our thinking about nature is already, it's not so much premeditated in the process itself, but it is part of its freedom. So this is kind of a maybe controversial alignment of German idealist philosophies of nature with someone like Delanda and then also McCarthy, because like for Schelling, the dichotomy of determinism and freedom, or nature and freedom, as they said in the 19th century, it's a false problem. It's not a dichotomy that holds, because for Schelling,
nature is only nature insofar as it includes the idea of freedom. And I find that really powerful and resonates strongly with McCarthy's conception of what nature is. Like, I think that's what I would say at this point.
The second question I had, but perhaps we can, it might not be possible for you to answer this, so, but it actually picks up on something that, well, it was, you actually anticipated, or anticipated the question really in your last response,
right.
But it's precisely that, the relationship for McCarthy between literature and nature. So you did sort of say, you know, it was part of that expression, if you like. I wonder if you could say a bit more about that, you know, as opposed to other modes of linguistic, like philosophy or something.
I mean, my way of thinking about that is, I mean, McCarthy has been read in terms of, like, and what today we call, like, the environmental humanities and so on, and various ways of reading landscapes in his fictions. And he has been aligned with, like, what in American studies we call nature writing. So like Thoreau and Annie Dillard and others. But I think rather than nature writing, rather than one writer taking account of what surrounds him or her, I think it is actually a much more, I don't want to say passive way of thinking about nature, but more like it's not nature writing, but it's writing nature. So literature is part of the process that it accounts for, and that's kind of a powerful way of thinking about this, so that narrative objects are not just cultural objects, but they're part and parcel of what they're talking about. So it's like this, that's kind of the difficulty about the, so far as I'm concerned with the Schellingian account of nature. Nature predates the thinking, the cultural thinking about nature, but it is only nature insofar as we think about it, because it is part of its capacity. So it you know, that's kind of what I was referring to in terms of antecedents and consequence. Nature antecedes freedom, human freedom, but it is only this type of antecedent insofar as the consequence acts upon it. And that's also what I think about the type of like literary practice in McCarthy. He's one of the few of his generation in American literature, I think, who have a concept like that, and that's what makes his writing so powerful.